events. So now you have this wildly exaggerated discussion about residential schools as being all bad. Well, that's not true, and you can even prove that to yourself by reading the Truth and Reconciliation Report.
Hi everybody, Michael Thiessen here, and today I get to speak with Brian Giesbrecht. And Brian is a senior fellow at the Frontier Center for Public Policy. And today, Brian and I might be having the most controversial, sensitive, inflammatory discussion I may ever have in my adult life, because today we are going to talk about the Indian residential schools and their relationship to critical race theory. So, Brian, thank you so much for coming on and being bold enough to have a conversation about this very loaded issue.
I'm glad to be here. It is a loaded issue. I agree with you.
I kind of feel like you and I are both about to stare down a loaded barrel of a double-barreled 22, but I think it's a critical issue to be talking about. Okay, so here's what we're going to do. First of all, everybody, what you need to understand is as we look south of the border, we are seeing critical race theory, which is a theory that wants to divide people into race classes, wants to say that one race is systemically racist, they would be an oppressor, and they oppress all other races, or each race feels that oppression with different severity. And of course, this is lived out in the American narrative as the black against white, or the white oppressor against black oppressed framework. In Canada, we don't feel often that we're talking about critical race theory as much as the Americans, but we really do in Canada, where there is a prolonged narrative that whites have been systemically racist to the indigenous people of our country. And so we don't hear about critical race theory as overtly. We're starting to hear about it clearly. There was a bill just recently put across the Ontario Queen's Park that had critical race theory in it. But we have been hearing about this for decades, and it is through the relationship between how Canadians feel and what we are told about our European relationship with the indigenous communities of our country. So Brian is here from the Frontier Center for Public Policy to kind of help us navigate what I hope to be a very good, profitable discussion about it. So Brian, with that context, with that framework, feel free to add any of your nuances to it. But why don't you start with explaining what the Frontier Center for Public Policy is, and then jump right into anything that you want to start talking about when it comes down to this topic.
Okay, the Frontier Center is a conservative think tank, and the fundamentals are free speech and belief in civil liberties and a fiscally conservative outlook. And I've been with them for a number of years now. More lately, I've been associated with an informal group that has been delving into the missing children and unmarked graves controversy. This is related, of course, to the residential school. I wrote I was writing a column for a newspaper, Winnipeg Sun, and I wrote what turned out to be a controversial column a year ago, and basically I said, and this was when we had all of the almost hysteria over the supposedly murdered children or missing children, and I said, wait a minute, let's look at history first and let's see what was happening in that history. Let's not get carried away here. This doesn't sound believable that we had priests or nuns somehow causing the death of children and having six-year-olds forced to bury them. This doesn't sound like the Canada I know. And I also said that the residential school controversy was by this time fundamentally hurting Canada, damaging Canada. And I said, with any historical wrong, what should be done is apologies should be made, compensation should be made, and then the country should move on. And I said, we have been dealing with the residential school issue for many years, and the compensation has been paid, many apologies have been given, and for the good of the entire country, and particularly for the good of Indigenous youth who are by now convinced that they're living in a genocidal country, which is completely wrong, we should move on. That particular column caused outrage, and as a result, I became determined to look into this this question in greater detail. So a group of us, and there are researchers, we have academics, and a number of people have been doing research and writing essays and articles about this for some time. So that's where I come from, and your introduction was very appropriate, I think, as an introduction to what I'd like to say, because as far as the critical race theory type of beliefs, I think we've taken things even further in this country than they have in the United States. For instance, this entire hysteria, and I think it is national hysteria, over the supposed secret burials of 215 and now thousands of children, is based on not on evidence, because there's practically no evidence. What the chief in that case told us is that there was a way of knowing in the community. In other words, there's some sort of secret way of knowing only known to Indigenous people, or only to people in that particular community. Now, I'm sorry, but I'm a judge, and what I was a judge, and what I dealt with every day was evidence. You have to show the evidence, and there is no such thing as one particular racial group or ethnic group having some secret way of knowing that is superior to the usual finding of evidence and factual evidence. But that's what the country ran with, and that's what virtually all of our major journalists, for instance, went along with, and even our prime minister went along with that, and the senior clergy too. They just bowed down to this, what is essentially nonsense. And I don't want to be insulting here, because I fully understand that Indigenous people do have a concept called traditional knowledge, and any pre-literate culture has that, and it's very valuable. For instance, in the knowledge that they gain that certain plants or whatever have medicinal qualities, that's very valuable information. And I don't at all criticize that or mock that. That's valuable information. But the idea that there is a way of knowing, and this is what the chief said, she said they had a way of knowing that six-year-olds were forced out of their beds late at night in order to go and secretly bury the bodies of their comrades. Now, that there is no evidence to back that up at all. There is a ground-penetrating radar findings, which are basically findings of soil disturbances, but even there we have reason to doubt that evidence, because the operator, the person who obtained that evidence, said she based her her examination, where to do the examination on this way of knowing. So I think we do have some type of strange, and it is related to this, the idea that different races are different. They're not. There's no such thing as different races being fundamentally different than other people. No, everybody has their own culture, and et cetera, but people are people, and indigenous people are just people. So that's where I come at it from, Mike.
Okay, I appreciate that, Brian. And I kind of want to keep framing the conversation, because what we're going to do is we're going to go back and we're going to maybe start from ground zero chronologically.
Yeah.
We're going to talk a little bit broadly about the residential schools.
Yeah.
And then we're going to talk chronologically about the finding of these recent mass graves that they're talking about. And by the way, I would agree with you. I confronted our denomination recently for their Twitter account that, you know, came up with some sanctimonious, let us be the first to listen. Well, listen for what? We listen for evidence. So, okay, mm-hmm. Let me frame this up a little bit. So for our listeners, during an election year last year, if you will remember, what we found was that our Canadian flag was kept at half mast for months. We found that our Canada Day celebrations, Liberty Coalition Canada actually helped sponsor and worked with a number of groups to run Canada Day celebrations in Ottawa, because the Canada Day celebrations were canceled, and what was in place was a massive Every Child Matters march in Ottawa. We had the Liberal government platforming on this idea of we've got to rectify the wrongs of the past, and we've got to overcome this this culture of genocide. We had all of those narratives going on last year because of this story. Mm-hmm. And Brian, just again to keep framing the conversation, when anybody tells you, I have a secret way of knowing, but I can't give you evidence, you know, we have that within Christianity too. Right. We have, usually I'll just flat out as a pastor and a Christian man, just call that person a liar. Because when someone tries to say, I know something that you can't possibly know, look at, it's a totally different statement for someone to say, I believe something by faith that I can't prove, to which at that point, we are changing the nature of the conversation from a criminal investigation to an epistemological discussion, maybe a theological discussion. But when we're talking about the criminal code, when we're talking about crimes against real individuals in an actual context, we have to have evidence. Our entire criminal system is based upon the concepts of two or three witnesses. It's based upon the concept of cross-examination. So what's been, you know, within, you know, early Christianity and other world religions, there's always this sense of Gnosticism, which means I know something special that you don't know. And there's no credibility about that, even in the philosophical sense of the phrase, let alone an actual situation where a country is supposed to be operating with, you know, retribution and those types of things. So that's just further framing for the conversation, just for me to agree wholeheartedly that we all have a tendency sometimes to say something that we don't want to have to prove. But that is not a standard for court. And what the country continues to do is act as judge and jury about these things when we've started off our conversation talking about the lack of evidence. So, Brian, could you, for our listeners, try to help them have a more historical perspective on what actually happened with was there any virtue in the residential school movement? Were the abuses widespread? help our listeners get a more realistic historical vision of the residential schools. And I'm sure that that's going to include, you know, many different details that, that folks don't know.
Well, I'll start with a bit of history. In the residential schools, mainly educated people from the Prairie Provinces, British Columbia, and Northern Ontario, only later, really, Quebec. There was only one residential school in the Maritimes at Schenectady. And the reason is because the Plains Indians in particular were in a terrible state, really, when the buffalo were disappearing and the settlers were coming in. And I will talk a little bit about that history because I think it's extremely relevant. The treaties, they started to sign the treaties in the early 1870s. The Indians were promised and demanded and asked for schools. And treaties basically said where the Indians requested a school, the government was obliged to build a school. And that was done, though that promise was honored. Just about all of the chiefs recognized that a modern education, or at least modern as of 1870, was absolutely fundamental, because as I said, the buffalo were gone, the old way of life was gone, and learning English and learning the other subjects was very important if Indigenous kids were going to have a chance to succeed. The day schools, that's what they were called, and I won't go into a lot of history about why it just wasn't working, but they weren't working very well. A part of it is cultural. In some of the Indian languages, they had a word for school, and it was to sit. In other words, you go into a school and you sit. Well, that was completely alien to the culture, and almost anything would interrupt the school. If there was if the northern areas, if the caribou were running, or you know, down south, if a moose was spotted or something like that, the schools would close. I mean, I'm oversimplifying it here, but basically, it was recognized very, very early on by both the white politicians as well as the progressive chiefs that they had to find better ways to educate Indigenous kids, because the Indian kids were just not getting an education. The residential school program was then devised. Now, the original concept was from a fellow by the name of Nicholas Flood Davin, and he devised the concept of the industrial school. And I'll just go into a little bit of detail, not too much, because it does get very complicated. But this was based on the American boarding school program, which had been in operation for a while. So the idea was these large schools, these large industrial schools, would be built fairly far away from the reserves. And Indian kids would go to school for the half day, and then they would work. They would sort of work at a trade in the afternoon. So some of these schools were built, and it was actually very expensive for a very poor country like Canada. And we have to remember that Canada at that time had been almost bankrupt by the building of the CPR railway, and times were tough. They were in recession, and yet we have to remember that Canada was actually building residential schools, that is, educational facilities for Indian kids, at a time when the Americans were still at war with Indians. So I think we should give ourselves a bit of a pat on the back for that, because the idea was good. In any event, to shorten this, the industrial schools just weren't working. They were too expensive, for one thing. And another thing, the Indian people didn't want their children that far away from them. So the move was to build what have now been called residential schools closer to the reserves. So there are still some of these industrial schools where the Indians from far away would come, but most of the schools were either on the reserves or closer to the reserves. So the idea of the school was simple. You were going to provide an education for the children. The government was not able to really afford to operate a complete school system by itself, so it partnered with the churches, and you had roughly half of the churches being run by the Catholic Church, and half run by the various Protestant denominations. So that was, in part, that was a cost-cutting method by the government, but it was also because, of course, the churches were very much in competition. The Catholics and Protestants, for instance, really fought over converts. I mean, that was the world of yesterday. So kids would go to the school that their parents chose. By this time, almost all of the Indian people were Christians of one sort or another. So Catholic parents would send their kids to the Catholic schools, and Protestant parents would send their kids to the Protestant schools. There was Methodist and later United and Anglican, even Mennonite and a few other denominations. But one of the common misconceptions is that the parents were forced to send their children to school, and that is just not the case. Prior to 1920, there was no compulsory education at all, and even after that date, parents were able to choose, Indigenous parents were able to choose whether to send their children to a day school, that is a school right on the reserve, or a residential school. It was only in areas where there were no day schools available that parents were required to send their children to residential schools. So one of the common misconceptions, and you see this on CBC all the time, that 150,000 children were forced to attend residential school. Well, it just isn't true. Most of those parents signed applications, in many cases, and I have I have copies of all of these things. In many cases, the parents were not able to get their children into school because there was simply not room for them. The schools were never designed to handle all of the Indigenous children. At the peak time of enrollment, which was 1931, less than 30% of the children Indigenous children went to a residential school, and that went down to about 5%. So the only thing you can say is, with any truth about a percentage, is that somewhere between 5 and 30% of Indigenous children ever attended a residential school. So you can see there that most of the children attended day school, and a shockingly surprisingly amount of the Indigenous children attended no school at all, even up to the 1940s. 40% of the children, of Indigenous children, were not attending any school at all, and of the other people attending day schools, they were getting, in many cases, an inferior education for many complicated reasons. So in short, the idea of the residential school was to provide an education for the children. And no, there were a lot of problems. It was there, a lot of mistakes were made. Many children suffered abuse. There's absolutely no question about that. But the idea that the people setting up these schools, at great sacrifice, and the nuns and the priests and the ministers and people running these schools were somehow trying to commit genocide or do something awful, is completely misguided and misplaced. The idea of cultural genocide or genocide is a smear. And it's a slur on every Canadian and on our history. It's just not true. It was, at worst, it would be called a bungled attempt at education. So rather than me ramble on, you can ask me some questions. Sure.
No, I really appreciate that, Brian, because I would look at our education system today and I go, that's a bungled attempt at education.
Yeah.
I'm a homeschooling father.
Uh-huh.
Let me give you a few examples of this. We have missionary families who traveled all around the world and adopted this boarding school mentality for their children. So somebody would be in Southern Africa and they'd send their kids all the way to Northern Africa to certain schools there, mm-hmm. or somebody would be, we see within the foreign ministry, the same type of historical development where, based upon the British boarding school, American boarding school, this idea that children being apart from their parents are going to go to school. I'm just saying it still happens today. There's popular boarding schools. And as a homeschooling dad, I'm always going to say philosophically, I'm against that style of education. I think children need their parents. And so therefore I would use that word bungle, like as a homeschooling dad who looks at the public system right now today, I'd go, look, wait a minute. I can walk in there. I can show you abuse. I can show you criminal behavior. I can show you all of these things happening within the public and Catholic school today. And nowhere in there though, is this overarching narrative that one race was trying to eliminate another race. And by the way, there's only one human race, one ethnic group trying to eliminate another ethnic group. We're all one human race. There are no actually different races. We're just different levels of melatonin in our body. But all that to say, I really like your description, Brian, because it seems accurate of what I know both Christians, politicians, and educators and parents want. You know, the politicians are wanting a good transition and assimilation into Canadian culture. The Indigenous parents are wanting their children to be able to thrive. You know, Brian, I sit down with my kids and I say, okay, the two languages I want you to learn are Spanish and Mandarin. Like, I'm not sitting here going, for the future, you know, English is going to be the dominant language. No. We're seeing Mandarin and Spanish skyrocketing. Mandarin around the world and Spanish. So I'm going to want my kids to know those things. I have three biological children and one adopted from China. And I want all of my kids to learn Spanish and Mandarin if we can achieve that. The Christians, absolutely the Christians want to make converts. That's because we really believe that the Bible is the wisdom for the world, that salvation's found in Jesus. So of course we're going to partner with the education system. So what you're describing is a community making an attempt at a point in history. And I'm going to sit back and go, maybe the biggest bungle is the residence idea, but that's more a criticism of boarding school. But it is certainly not what's being painted for us when critical race theorists are just trying to use this as political capital. And when you have a very motivated community of contemporary Indigenous people who get a great benefit from this narrative continuing to be pushed onto the Canadian people.
Yeah.
Brian, if someone wanted to look up some primary resources on the residential schools, where would you send them? Like, for example, you know, Egerton Ryerson, you know, Ryerson University in this country is renaming itself because they want to separate from Ryerson himself, and he was the father of a national education vision, and you know, tried to promote education for all Canadian citizens. Where are some places you can send people to? Would you send them to your website? Where else would you send them?
Yeah, I would, and this is self. advertising, I guess, but the book.
Not really. I asked you to share, so it's not self-advertising. Okay.
From Truth Comes Reconciliation is the book that was edited by Rod Clifton and Mark DeWolf, and I'm one of the authors of that book. There are a number of people that I'm associated with who've written a chapter. It is published by the Frontier Center, and I think that's a very good start because it also gives you an excellent a number of links, and you can start with that one, and it will take you many different places. So that's called From Truth Comes Reconciliation. You can also Google anything I've written over the years, and there's quite a bit. I would point you to essays as well written by Tom Flanagan and by Francis Widdowson. Those are two, there are many more in our group. But that would be at least a good start. And just one of the points that you raised that I wouldn't mind elaborating on a little bit is you're talking about how the racial thing and the critical race part of it has sort of come into the picture. And I think I have seen that even in my daily work as a judge, because I became a judge in 1976, and I've had many discussions with Indigenous people about residential schools and their experience in residential schools, and generally, there was usually an expression of loneliness. They were lonely, and they had other complaints. But there was never the what we're hearing today, where there was this house of horrors idea that residential schools were all bad. It was actually quite a balanced view, and most Indigenous people, every other person, they have different opinions, but there was a pretty reasonable take on these things. It was not hard to find a person to have discussions with about residential schools, but then it became entirely political, and I'm not sure that I exactly understand all of this. But first of all, the financial part entered in, and then the somewhere along the line, the would you call it the woke part or the critical race part or the whatever, the postmodernist part came in and completely distorted the arguments. So now you have this wildly exaggerated discussion about residential schools as being all bad. Well, that's not true, and you can prove that to yourself by reading the Truth and Reconciliation Report. Maybe the most important historian, at least according to the Truth and Reconciliation people, was Jim Miller, was a well-respected historian in Canada. And he wrote, one of his articles was called The Ironies of Residential Schooling. And he was very sympathetic to the complaints about the inadequacies of the schools, and he wrote a great deal about it. But at the same time, he pointed out that the last few generations of Indigenous leaders actually were educated at residential schools. So you had many people who had no education at all, or a very inadequate education. Those are not the people who became the leaders and the leading families. It was, in fact, the people who had gone through the residential school system. So I'm not trying to praise the residential schools, because they obviously had a lot of failings. They definitely did. And there were all kinds of things that were done wrong, and many people were really harmed as a result of it. But at the same time, we have to recognize that, yes, in addition to the the harm. The schools also did a lot of good. And that is almost impossible to say now without being called names, but it's only fact. So and if you want me to talk about, I don't know, do you want to lead directly into the last year's controversy about the missing children and the unmarked graves, etc.? Would you like me to talk about some of those definitions so people have a better understanding of them?
Yeah, that's exactly where I want to go. I was going to transition just with the thought of, if people were to look back 150 years upon what's going on in Canada right now, I just want to reiterate, we would be able to find the same levels of the same levels of sin, the same levels of abuse. Like, you know, I'm thinking right now, like we lived in the Boston area when 9/11 happened. And we lived in the Boston area when you found out about a number of sexual abuses, the sexual abuse scandal in the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. Abuse of children is never, it's one of the most heinous crimes on earth. It's never something to be overlooked. The point that I'm trying to make is that, you know, we can go through the news and we can talk about humans' our depravity, our failure to live virtuously. And, you know, you could document all of the mass shootings going on all around the world right now in schools. You could document racial violence. You can document female on male violence. Humans collectively make bad decisions. We always choose, unless we are restrained, we struggle with the temptation of doing evil things. Mm-hmm. And so I just really appreciate, Brian, the way that you're positioning the conversation in a balanced way that recognizes that people still did wrong things within this context, but the entire system itself had no overarching goals that would be uncommon to our experience today. The overarching goals would have been the goals of the parents, the goals of the politician, the goals of the teachers, and the goals of people who are motivated to educate children. I appreciate that. And I just wanted to repeat that for our listeners. Like, nowhere in this discussion is anybody going to try to whitewash individual operators who are sinning. The issue is whether or not these things were designed with the narrative that has been, you know, shoved down our throat as Canadians. So, Brian, yes, now with that being said, I do want you to go into, because I think last year was a perfect example of a narrative with zero evidence, mm-hmm. of a narrative that you've already stated, and I agree with you 100%, that is extremely political. It was done in a year of an election. It was done right in order to deter people's attention from all of the mandates that are been so awful in this country. And it was just the perfect narrative at the perfect time. And yet it was built on a house of cards. Go ahead and walk us through last okay. year, please.
I will. And I'll just add, because your point brought up another interesting point, as so often happens, the idea that we today are virtuous, but our ancestors were awful racists and everything. It's just, of course, nonsense. Now, there's a concept called presentism, and that's the idea of judging yesterday's people by today's standards. Well, the fact is that a person in 1880 thought differently and talked differently than a person today. But at the same time, the idea that there were simply more evil people then than now or something like that is nonsense. The truth is that most of the teachers and most of the priests and nuns and the teachers and the ministers at the residential schools were every bit as good and well-intentioned as anybody today. And trying to vilify those people and demonize them and suggest that they were a bunch of sex abusers is just not true. Regrettably, there are always sex abusers lurking wherever there are children. And I don't know what the percentage is, something like generally 2% across the board, whether it's a residential school or whether it's a public school or whatever. And the only study I've seen on residential schools is that as far as priests abusing children, it was something like 2%. In other words, there is a constant. There are abusive people like that, and that's sad. But there weren't any more men back still then today, than there are now. Yeah,
men still today get on airplanes from Canada.
Yeah,
and fly to countries where they can abuse children legally, and then come back home. And this idea of progressivism is just a modern idea to massage people into the elites. The reality is that the same standards have applied to humanity and will condemn or will vindicate individuals. And all of us struggle with that. So thank you for making that. Thank you for picking up on that and making that point, because we might have some things where we think differently, but murder was always murder. It will always be murder.
Yeah. Yeah.
Child abuse has always been child abuse. There's nobody who gets to stand before God at the end of the age and say, "But I didn't know I was abusing children." Nope. Like we all have a conscience stricken makeup. Today we victimize people all the time, and then we villainize people in the past, when in reality we're all villains, and some of us are restrain our villainry, and that makes us virtuous.
So I
really appreciate that.
Yeah, and I should make it clear that anybody who was victimized and abused by, say, somebody working at a residential school deserves our sympathy and deserves every bit of compensation they received. There's no question about that. And the question is, let's put this in context, and let's just realize that, yes, education was not handled very well at residential schools in many instances, but the purpose was honorable. The original idea was not to kill a culture. The idea was to make a future possible for Indigenous kids. On May 27th last year, Chief Roseanne Casimir of the Tecumloops band at Kamloops made the very shocking announcement that it was her belief that 215 children from the residential school had somehow been murdered or otherwise killed and then secretly buried at the in the apple orchard at the grounds of the band. According to her, there was a way of knowing in the community that children, even as young as six, had been forced to get out of their beds and help bury these bodies. Now, right from the start, the only evidence that they offered, and they offered this as evidence, was very anomalous evidence of ground-penetrating radar, which is basically a machine. It looks like it's about the size of a lawnmower, and it detects disturbances in the soil. But those soil disturbances can be anything. And even the person who operated the machine admitted that until there was excavation, there was no way that she could say, or any scientist could say, that those were graves. They might have the characteristics of a grave, but they might also be something completely different. So in other words, only excavation could have proved whether or not there was a grave there or not. Well, here's what should have happened, I believe. The RCMP should immediately have taken charge of that investigation. Here, murder and secret burial was alleged. That was the crime alleged. There is nothing more serious. The RCMP should immediately have secured the area. That means locking everything up, moving other unauthorized people out of there, and taking charge of the investigation. Then they should have done an excavation if they believed that they had any evidence at all, any reason at all to do so. Now, that would have been a relatively simple matter. The soil disturbances were supposedly, apparently, very close to the surface, so probably a small area could have been tested. In other words, the soil scraped off. And that's what should have happened. So the RCMP should immediately have done their job and taken charge of the investigation, and that probably would have ended the matter. Instead, they didn't. Instead, they said, and one of the calls to action in the Truth and Reconciliation Report had said, Indigenous communities should be able to handle their own excavations and investigations. And that was a very bad idea. The police should never have gone along with that, and the politicians shouldn't either, because there's always the danger of tampering with evidence, of incompetently conducting an investigation. So that's the first big mistake that was made. The second major mistake was that the journalists said nothing. They asked no questions. They were being told that there was this way of knowing that six-year-olds were helping bury bodies that had somehow been secretly disposed of. Well, any journalist worth their salt should have said, well, who are these six-year-olds, and they must be grown up now. We want to question them. In actual fact, if the police had done their job, the police would immediately have found out if there were any potential witnesses, and they would have questioned these people. So the journalists then started writing feverish articles feverishly, and they started alleging things like mass graves. And those claims went right around the world. Now, mass graves denotes Holocaust, genocide, and horrible things. Now, in actual fact, the chief at Kamloops came out the next day or a couple of days later and said, well, actually, we're not saying mass graves. But the damage had already been done. Many of the leaders had already made these wild claims about these graves. So immediately, huge mistakes were made, and this was compounded by the political leadership, because, as you say, the government was playing games, political games, with this. And I think you're quite right that diversion from the pandemic mistakes that they'd been making made this a natural story for them. Well, lowering the flags for months was just incredibly awful, an incredibly awful thing to do. And Michael, I'll give you an example of how much harm this has done to Canada internationally. Canada was playing a very important part in the campaign to expose the situation of the Uyghurs in China. And of course, as we know, their situation is awful, and they're being treated just terribly by the Chinese communists. Canada was in a very important position. Well, that was all completely blown out of the water by these claims that Canada was committing genocide. So immediately, as soon as our prime minister did this with the lowering of the graves and talking about later about the burning of the churches as being understandable, completely inappropriate, this damaged Canada incredibly internationally. China was using this this propaganda against us, talking about Canada as a genocidal nation. Other nations were doing this as well. We were totally discredited, and I think Canada's reputation has probably been dragged into the mud now for the next couple of decades. It's going to be an awful long time before we can recover. Sorry, you were going to say something?
Well, I just want to jump in and try to give people an analogy of the situation. So this situation would be like, I live on 10 acres. I've got four children and a wife. Probably should have said a wife and four children. Honor my wife better. Sarah, if you're listening, wife, four children, love you, dear. It would be like my, it would be like we had one of our children go missing. Let's say the second or third born, and the RCMP coming by and saying, okay, we want to investigate, and saying, no, it's okay, we'll handle it. Mm-hmm. Like the people closest to the situation, of course, this is also now just again, so everybody remembers, this is also claiming that this happened up to 150 years ago. So we're now talking about no living witnesses. We're now talking about no immediate impact. We're talking about political impact, financial impact, and ongoing philosophical impact. But you know, there's no other situation in Canada where someone would say, well, look, I'm claiming that there's been murder, child abuse, and the RCMP doesn't criminally investigate. Nowhere else does anybody get to say, no, we got it, this is a family matter, we'll just handle it inside the family. I want to talk a little bit about kind of every little aspect. So first of all, has any excavation happened at all to this date? There's now been another site that Canadians have been told about. Have we seen any excavation? I remember watching a number of independent journalists try to get anywhere near these burial sites and not be allowed anywhere near these sites by the tribe in Kamloops. Have we seen any excavation done at all?
All right, I'll deal with that in just 1 minute. But again, you really raised an interesting point, and one of the reasons why it was so important for the RCMP immediately take charge of the investigation was because, according to some of these stories that are being were being told to reporters, the witnesses and even the perpetrators would still be alive. We'd be alive. So the last thing the police would want to do is let those people get away. If they at all believed these stories, and I don't think they do, but if they at all believed these stories, they'd want to immediately find out who the witnesses were, who the possible perpetrators were, so that they could interview them. But instead, as you say, just turning it over to homemade investigations and homemade excavations by the police, the chance of those people getting away, even though I don't think there are any such people, but it's completely irresponsible on the part of the police. And matter of fact, I believe that all of Canada's majors and major institutions have failed us in a big way. But to answer your question about excavations, no. Since May 27th, my understanding is that there has been no excavation at all, certainly not at Kamloops, where this started, or at Williams Lake, where these claims were even more extreme, with the chief alleging that priests murdered children and threw them into lakes and streams and into furnaces, etc. The claims were absolutely unbelievably anti-Catholic hatred. It's horrible. But in any event, none were done. However, There have been some excavations done before all of this happened. At the, I mentioned Shubnekadi in Nova Scotia. That was the only residential school in the Maritimes. There were those same stories about secretly buried children and priests murdering children. And these are conspiracy theories. Let's call them what they are. The same kind of stories. And they did do a proper excavation. And what they found is, yes, they did find graves. But they were the graves of Irish settlers who had died 100 years before the school was even open. So, in other words, there were no graves. There was nothing to those stories. There were similar excavations done elsewhere at the Camsell Hospital in Edmonton as well. Again, the same story, same wild stories about secretly buried children, and they found absolutely nothing. So, of the final excavation attempt I'll refer to happened 10 years ago at the Mohawk Institute in Brantford, and there the stories about secretly murdered children resulted in them hiring this fellow by the name of Kevin Annett. And I encourage all of your listeners to Google him and to watch his movie. It's called Unrepentant. And that may have you follow that up. There are hundreds of links. This is a fellow who was a former United Church minister who is in large part responsible for spreading all of these conspiracy theories. And his stories were so powerful that the Mohawk people at Brantford hired him to conduct an excavation. And excavations were done. He pretended to find the bones of children. And as a result of that, the Mohawks actually publicly denounced him and drove him out of the community. And once again, your listeners can Google that. They can go to Mohawks Denounce Kevin Annett, A-N-N-E-T-T, and that will provide an education, because what it shows is that at least a decade ago, and even longer, there were these wild and crazy stories going through Indigenous communities. The same stories about six-year-olds being forced to bury children, priests throwing children into furnaces, and wild stories like that. And let me just tell your listeners one story, and just to demonstrate how completely ridiculous these stories were. Every one of your listeners will, when they hear it, immediately say, well, that couldn't have happened. And yet, those stories are still around. One of the common stories was that in 1964, Queen Elizabeth had gone to the Kamloops Indian Residential School and had taken Indigenous children out on a picnic. And then she kidnapped, that is the Queen, kidnapped 10 of the children, and they were never seen again. Now, anybody listening to that story would realize, well, that's a crazy story. That is truly crazy. It couldn't have happened. And like every conspiracy theory or urban legend, there's always a kernel of truth. And in actual fact, if you look it up, you'll find that the Queen actually did visit. Queen and Prince Philip visited Canada in 1964. They didn't go to British Columbia, but I mean, there's always that little bit of kernel of truth that makes a conspiracy theory sort of interesting. But that story has been on the internet now for a couple of decades. There are even fact checks. There's a Snopes, there's a Reuters fact check. So I'm just telling that story to indicate how pervasive these conspiracy theories are and how much they seem to have taken hold in these Indigenous communities. So it's not just the Kamloops or Williams Lake thing, that communities that actually believe, and I feel sorry for people who actually believe these things, but they actually believe that priests were throwing children into furnaces and horrible things like that. But they've gone virtually viral. So in short answer to your question, there have been previous excavations and they have yielded absolutely nothing. They've shown that those stories about secretly buried children are just that, they're stories. Whether any excavation will ever take place, frankly, I doubt it. I don't think the Kamloops people are going to do it, because I think the leaders there know full well that there are no children buried there at all. And I don't think it's going to happen at these other places as well. In Saddle Lake, at the present time, that's the most recent one to announce these burials. Well, they're finding bones of people, and they're finding that there were indeed bodies buried, but this is in public cemeteries. These are in cemeteries. And so, yeah, sure, there would be kids from residential schools, but there would be kids, there would be adults from the community, there would be farmers from the community, etc. So if you want to go digging at a cemetery, you're going to find bodies. But the idea of that there are thousands of secretly buried missing children all over the country is absolutely preposterous. And just to show you one piece of evidence about just how to make it clear, one of the irresponsible claims that I've heard is that there are like more than 25,000 of these children who have gone to school, and disappeared, never to be seen again. That's what our National Center for Truth and Reconciliation has been telling us. They don't say 25,000. One other person did, but they're coming up with new figures all the time. Well, there hasn't been not one case, to my knowledge, there's been not one case of a parent, an Indigenous parent, saying to the police, look, my child went to a residential school and never came home. Indigenous parents are no different than any other parent. If their child doesn't come home, they're going to raise a hue and cry, and of course they should. There's been not one case of that. So the idea that there are thousands of these children who went to school and never were seen again is just absolute nonsense. And I believe that the RCMP actually know that. Otherwise, they would definitely investigate. But I do fault them for not doing their job. They've taken the politically easy way out. And what they should have done is said, no, this is a major crime that is being alleged, and we are determined to investigate. And they probably could have ended the matter right there when they found, no secretly buried bodies.
So, Brian, I want to ask you just a point of clarification, because you've dug into the research on this. Even when I said back to you, I said, the possibility of these alleged graves, you're now talking about a crime that, happened up to 150 years ago. And you clarified with me and you said, no, there's been some claims that those abused and some of the abusers still might be alive. Can you clarify for people? Because even in like a less critical race narrative, people might go, well, okay, like just like the Irish settlers that they found in Nova Scotia, maybe a virus went through the community and here what we have is an unmarked cemetery. People rapidly dying all at the same time would kind of maybe be more evidence for just a sickness going through the community. And in their mind, they're thinking the same thing I'm thinking of 150 years ago. Can you just maybe even help us better
Sure.
with the numbers?
Yeah, and that I think is one of the reasons people are having such difficulty understanding this, because an unmarked grave, there's nothing sinister about an unmarked grave. There are millions.
Or a grave that was marked with a cross that rotted.
Well, that is an unmarked grave. You see, that's my point. That's exactly right. There are millions of unmarked graves. In other words, poor people were buried, at least in the Christian tradition, with a Christian service and then a wooden cross. And in many cases, the wooden cross deteriorates. If a cemetery is not kept up, then that is an unmarked grave. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. In Indigenous communities, generally, many of them do not have a tradition of tending cemeteries. So there are literally tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of untended cemeteries all over the country. So there's nothing wrong with having an unmarked grave. There's also nothing unusual or nothing wrong with indigenous people trying to find out the birth or the burial places of their ancestors. That's perfectly legitimate. That's a common thing, and many groups have done that. I remember when the Chinese families were looking for ancestors who had worked on the Canadian on the CPR and had died, and they found that, you know, they put up a memorial for them and that sort of thing. It's perfectly understandable and acceptable. And even in where I live, close to where I live in Brandon, there was a person who was working for years on a project to try to locate the burial places of Indigenous students who had died at the residential school. Well, that's perfectly understandable and legitimate, but somehow people are conflating unmarked graves with clandestine burials or secret burials. They're totally different things. A person who has a normal Christian burial and then is buried in the ground, and his grave is not attended, that's an entirely different thing from somebody who was murdered in the middle of the night and buried by a six-year-old. So they've conflated these wild and crazy conspiracy theories with something that's perfectly normal, and I fear very badly for the indigenous people in the communities who are just conducting legitimate searches for the burial sites of their ancestors. As I say, that's perfectly legitimate, understandable. Everybody would do that. But that does not mean the fact that there's an unmarked grave, that you've forgotten where a person was buried. That has nothing to do with somebody who has been secretly murdered or mistreated. So I think it's that conflation that's made things so difficult. And the other thing that has caused such difficulty, and I blame the NCTR, that's the successor to the Truth and Reconciliation Committee, it's the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation. What they've done is they've made a big show of unfurling their blood red banner and saying, here are 2,800 missing children, and these children are missing, and they went to school and they never returned. Well, that is an outright lie. That is fraud, because our group has been researching this list, and those children they lived their lives and they died. Some of them died at residential schools, but no, most of them died sometimes long after going to the residential schools. But the thing is, none of them are missing. They're not missing at all. They are people who were buried, and then in many cases, where exactly they're buried now is it can be open to question. But for the NCTR to mislead Canadians like that and to give the impression, Canadians' impression, that these are missing children and that all of these searches all across the country are somehow looking for these children that are on their list, I think is absolutely inexcusable. And it's caused, as I mentioned that one example about the damage this has caused to Canada's reputation. But just imagine the damage this is causing even among Indigenous youth. We saw all of those church burnings last summer.
Yeah.
Well, if you are a young Indigenous person and you're being told that your country has committed genocide and that priests and nuns were murdering your ancestors, well, that is going to make you terribly bitter, terribly angry. And this is built and based on a lie. Canada is not a genocidal country and has never been a genocidal country. And people are being misinformed, misled, and lied to, Mike.
Well, Brian, I want to thank you for coming on, and hopefully we're going to talk to more, maybe talk to you again or talk to some more individuals from your group. I want to kind of close out with some final thoughts, and I'm going to do this, and you can feel free to disown me if you need to later, but you know, there are a few factors that go into this, right? To be able to hold the genocide card in your back pocket is like holding the cancer card in your back pocket. So I am the father of a cancer survivor, and I am so thankful to the Lord that my son survived cancer. But you want to know one thing that I miss about my son having cancer? People are going to go, oh my goodness, you're the most awful person in the world. But the reality of it is, oh, you want to get to the front of the line? Oh, let's just show the kids the little bald cancer child. Oh, you want something free? Oh, just show them your bald cancer child. Oh, you want, you became attuned to being treated special. Now, admittedly, people are compassionate. Admittedly, I fought my sinful nature to just want to exploit my child's very sincere illness. But at the end of the day, you 2 years outside of the cancer journey, you go, oh wow, I actually was treated very, I had special treatment. And politically, whoever wants to shout the loudest of the critical race theorist, or whoever wants to shout the historical genocide the loudest, it's an incredible card of power and preferred treatment. And it's their way of bullying the rest of our country into doing what they want. And so, and of course, one of the other things that happens out of this is ongoing repayment. So, you know, the idea of retribution or reconciliation is that a debt was owed, a debt is paid, now it's canceled, and now the debt has been paid. People, you know, in our Christian worldview, we'd say people at that point need to forgive and they need to heal. Other worldviews are going to do what they want, but before the law, a debt is owed, a debt is paid, it is reconciled, and now we move on. And even retribution in the criminal code, where we used to have forced labor, where it was seen that your time in prison would be productive, you'd be paying back society by doing work. What we have here is an ongoing motivator for greed, where again, time and time again, where you say, look, I just want a balanced approach. The balanced approach would be if someone claimed that murder had happened in our country, the RCMP would investigate. And no one gets to hold out a proper, no one gets to hold away at arm's length a criminal investigation. And we will go where the evidence follows. And then we'll deal with it. But as long as the Indigenous communities of Canada get to place these cards out and say, oh, but you can't investigate it. Oh, but we can't validate our claims. Oh, but we're going to rewrite history. There's really only two people that gain from that. And the people who gain from that are the politicians who are going to yell it loudly, and then those within the Indigenous community who are profiteering on the insider on the inside of the infrastructure. All that to say, I'm just saying that a simple criminal investigation would solve all of those problems, where you don't get to have this political or potentially financial motivation to keep selling these lies. And so that's why, Brian, I'm very pleased that you asked for that, where you said, look, the very first thing that should have been done was the RCMP done an excavation. Folks, you can hear within this research that Brian and his team have done, you can hear people pursuing truth. And Brian, I want to thank you for all of your work. If you want to push back on me for any of my final thoughts there, I'm willing to give you the last.
No, that's fine. No, I'm agreeing with you. I'm finding myself nodding along, so I'm agreeing with you.
Yeah, so we just look, if Canada is going to move forward and not just be handcuffed by this critical theory, this critical race theory, which breeds division in every avenue, men against women, race against race, class against class, we're going to have to return to the rule of law as we have known it, which is you do investigate and you do punish evil. But you don't rewrite history for your political or your financial advantages. So everybody, thanks for listening. We've gone an hour and 14 minutes, but I think you stuck with us because Brian was so interesting. Brian, thank you for coming on. Everybody, please make sure that you give us a 5-star rating, that you share this podcast around. More people need to hear this historical perspective. And Brian, I'm so thankful you came. Thank you for speaking with us today.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. Godspeed.